to what J.B. Phillips said. I love this. I just love the whole tone of J.B. Phillips' paraphrase of this. Verse 1, he says, "Now may I, who am myself an elder, say a word to you, my fellow elders? I speak as one who actually saw Christ suffer, and as one who will share with you the glories that are to be unfolded to us. I urge you then to see that your flock of God is properly fed and cared for. Accept the responsibility of looking after them willingly and not because you feel you can't get out of it." That really hit me when I read that. I'm trapped here. And as soon as I start thinking that way, the Lord says, "Bob, I'll give you the money. You can leave anytime you want. I don't force people to serve me." Yes, Lord. Looking after them willingly and not because you feel you can't get out of it. Doing your work not for what you can make, but because you're really concerned for their well-being. I love that. I think that's very, very faithful to the tone of the original text. So Peter says, as a fellow elder, I appeal. I'm offering you some counsel, some advice, as an equal. And he said, as an eyewitness, what's the deal with being an eyewitness? I think my NIV says as a witness of Christ's sufferings, but the Greek word speaks of an eyewitness. And that, I don't know why, that just makes it a little bit stronger. And that's why J.B. Phillips says, I actually saw this happen. I was with Jesus. I saw the Jesus model. I saw the way he lived his life. I heard directly with my own earballs, and I saw with my eyeballs what he said and what he did. Why is that a big deal? Well, because by the time Peter wrote this, and the church has spread all over the then known world, most of those people had never seen Jesus. Most of the leaders had never seen Jesus. They believed the testimony of the eyewitnesses. By then, the Gospels were written. They believe that eyewitness testimony, and you, well, that's you and I, isn't it? We didn't see him, but we believe the message, and we invited him in, and he transformed our lives, and you could never convince me he's not real. But I never got to see him the way Peter did. So I think it's interesting. I think it's also interesting the way that I read this in my mind is because the story is circulated. If you've got the Gospels, you see Peter at his worst, right? So somebody says, "We've got a letter from some guy named Peter that we want to read to everybody this morning here in Smyrna," or wherever it was that they were. And they start reading, and people are going, Peter who? And then they just hear a few lines, and they go, "Oh, that Peter." You know, nudge, nudge, grin and wink. "Oh, Peter that can't keep his foot out of his mouth. Peter, the guy who boasted and fell on his lips. Oh, that Peter." So I find there's an extra bit of humility in that. But he has credibility, doesn't he? Because he saw the Jesus model. I told a story when we talked about this before. My cell phone is buzzing, but it won't let me turn it off. Sorry. I should have left it in the office. Don't you ever do that, what I just did. When you're constructing a house and you have 20 rafters to cut, the policy is you measure perfectly that first rafter and you use it to mark every single rafter. You don't make one rafter cut and then use the one you just cut to make another rafter cut and another. Because by the time you get through all 20 rafters, you're going to be half to 3/4 of an inch off. So you follow that original template. That's the only way to be accurate. I asked the question earlier, because the teaching from Jesus himself and from here from Peter is so clear, you wonder how the church could have gotten so far off course. The answer is astonishingly simple. the church stopped using the original template. I know it was that way in the denomination I grew up in. People didn't even really study the Bible or teach the Bible. Pastors went to a school that just cranked out cookie-cutter pastors, and guys copied the style of the guy they learned from. And you got one rafter making a copy, and that rafter makes another copy, and you get so far off. You know what I mean? It's so easy to get even a one-degree compass error. And a one-degree compass error, if you follow it far enough, will put you hundreds and hundreds of miles off course. The only way that that can be prevented is that we model ourselves by the original template. That's why one of the great values that I see in this. So Peter is making an appeal. It's not a commandment. His whole posture in this is speaking to equals. Here's another thing I just want to pass on to you before I get to verse 2. By the way, we're only doing a few verses, so we're going to squeeze all the juice out of this. This is like what your friend Steve calls my Bible study, that's like a juicer, where you just stick everything and you just get everything out and then suck the pulp, you know, when you're done. I love that. When Jesus told Peter, which we studied last week or the week before on Sunday, he told Peter he was going to fail. He also told Peter in the same moment he told him he was going to fail, he told him he was going to be restored. And he gave him a job to do. When Jesus said that, wrap your brain around this. When Jesus said that, Jesus saw this letter being written years later. See, when God talks about the future, it's because he sees it happening. It's not a guess. It's not even an educated guess. It's not even a wholly educated guess. When he talks about the future, he sees it. He's there. He's not confined to the linear unfolding of the time-space continuum like we are. Why is that important? Well, he talks a lot about your future. Philippians 1:6. He who began a good work in you will what? Will complete it. That's always the way he looks. I gave up on myself many times. I'm so glad he didn't. I can't tell you how many times I've just written invisible letters of resignation. And Jesus has said, son, give me another shot at it, okay? I'll grow you up. So Peter, just what a beautiful juxtaposition to look at the Gospels. We just looked at Peter's worst failure. This coming Sunday, we'll look at 5 steps to his downfall. We're going to see Peter at his absolute worst moment. Now here we are on Wednesdays, and we're studying Peter, the guy who's done it right more than he's done it wrong. But we see humility. We see him not giving orders, not making boastful braggadocio over his underlings. We see him appealing in humility. I just love that. So here's the counsel that he gives, starting in verse 2. Starts with that verb, shepherd. Shepherd the flock of God. And I want to just spend a little bit of time talking about shepherds. Of all of the examples that the Bible uses about leadership, this is the figure that it uses most often. Probably not, it's not one of those examples that's really in the front of me. I love sailing analogies because I'm a sailor, and I know guys like carpenter analogies and guys like sports analogies. But shepherds and sheep were used a lot. In fact, Israel is called a flock of sheep all through the Old Testament prophets. And, of course, it was a common part of their culture. And last night, in my 2 or 3 people in my Bible study up in Rockland, I happened to say, well, you know, not too many of us really know what it's like to be a shepherd. And one lady raised her hand, and wouldn't you know? After I make a statement like that, you know, she had been a professional sheep sitter for a while, and so I'm just not going to go there again. But just let me talk about this for a minute, because so much of what Jesus said about himself, so much of what he said about his style, so much of counsel that is given to leaders and even parents, anybody that's got a ministry to somebody else, this is the analogy that's always used. A couple of things that are noteworthy. Number one is that sheep cannot be driven. Sheep have to be led. The whole rolling, 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 you know, that whole rawhide thing, that's cows. It's not sheep. You try to do that with sheep and they will go in circles. I loved that show. I was not allowed to watch it because it was on Sunday nights. And if you watch TV instead of going to church on Sunday nights, the church I was raised in, you're going to hell in a handbasket. I hated that. Sorry, where was I going? Sheep. Sheep have to be led. Not dream. Sheep are just natural born followers, and that is supposedly a good thing. It just depends on who's leading them. When I was a kid, we had a small flock of 12 sheep. They're stupid. I don't know how to say it in a politically correct way. They're stupid. One of them broke through the fence. They're always trying to break through the fence. This is another thing about sheep. They never like where they are. They always want to go over the fence because, of course, the grass is much better over there. Does this sound familiar? Isn't it interesting that we're called sheep? We're not called lions. We're not called, you know, gorillas in the Bible. We're called sheep. One of our sheep busted through. He was always trying to break through the fence. This time he got through, fell in the river, and all of the 11 other sheep followed him. They all fell in the river, and they all drowned. That's not an uncommon occurrence. Here's another thing about sheep. Sheep are one of the few animals that cannot retrace their steps. If they get lost, they can't find their way back. Somebody has to go out and get them. I don't know if they don't leave a pheromone trail. I don't know what the deal is. You know, like the squirrels that live in my house that have lived in there since time immemorial. You know, generation upon generation, and not, no matter what I try, I'm sorry, I'm venting on squirrels, aren't I? Sheep have to be led. Sheep can't find their way back. My first group that I took to Israel, we had a wonderful thing happen. We were on our way up from Caesarea Philippi, and we didn't actually go on this road on this last trip, but we did on the one before. Headed up the slopes of Mount Hermon, narrow, windy road, lush green grass all around. And as we're heading up, our tour bus stopped, and people started rolling down the windows and, you know, running to the front and grabbing their cameras because there were two flocks of sheep, one on either side of the road. One was coming down the hill, and another was coming up the hill. And the first thing that I noticed was the shepherds were in front of the sheep, not behind them. Forget the rawhide thing. They were walking in front. Now, one was sort of a middle-aged guy, and he was singing, coming down the hill. And the other was led by a little boy, maybe 10 or 11 years old. He had a stick with a bell on it. Then he was ringing the bell, and he was singing too. And as they're headed down to the road, I realized one of them just came back from watering the sheep. The other's on the way down. And I thought, there's 100 sheep in each of these flocks, and they're going to converge. And how in the world how are they ever going to get their sheep back? But the interesting thing was, as the flocks converged, the guys kept singing, the boy kept dinging his bell, and they just kept walking, and all the sheep just kept following. And our tour guide picked up the little microphone and said, "Ooh, ooh, ooh, this is the perfect example of what Jesus was talking about. My sheep recognize my voice and they will not follow another." He said the reason that these sheep, the reason the men are singing, the reason the boy's dinging the bell, is because these sheep have not heard any other human voice other than that voice. And probably this little boy, every time he takes his sheep anywhere, rings this little bell. And if somebody's in front of them that's not talking, whose voice they recognize and not ringing that little bell, they won't go anywhere. Perfect illustration. The sheep have to be led. Doesn't that fit beautifully into the way that Jesus is? The Bible says, Jesus himself said, that the ideal shepherd goes before his sheep. He's leading the way. I find that so comforting. I mean, stuff's always taken me by surprise. But I don't have to know what's ahead. All I have to do is follow him. He's the one. He's already there. You know what I mean? So, a couple of years ago at a pastor's conference down in Cape May, or near there somewhere, I heard a guy saying that he had just gotten back from Israel, and he said, we saw a flock of sheep on the road. So our bus stopped, and the guy was behind them, and he was screaming at the sheep, and he was hitting the ground with his stick, and he was hitting the sheep. And so somebody rolled down the window and said, hey, I thought shepherds weren't supposed to, you know, drive the flock and weren't supposed to speak. And a guy laughed and he says, I'm not the shepherd. I'm the butcher. And I thought, oh, boy, that preaches really well, doesn't it? About leading and driving. Here's the irony to me. Especially here in this state. I've seen many churches where the pastors try to drive the sheep and coerce and, you know what I mean? They're controlling, and those churches are flourishing. I don't get it. I just don't understand it. I know it's not Jesus' way. I don't know why people put up with it. Let's look at what Peter has to say. When he talks about shepherding God's flock, the Amplified Bible gave some great synonyms, didn't it? Tend, nurture, guard, guide, and fold. I didn't know what that word meant. I mean, I know folding, you know, like a taco, you know, or folding like clothes. And believe me, I know about folding clothes. I have six brothers and sisters, and I folded all the clothes. But I didn't know what folding was in terms of a shepherd. So I looked it up. And the word means, it means to gather together for protection. Ever seen sheepdog trials at a fair? Or Highland Games, I think they were at this last Highland Games that we went to. That's the sheepdog's job, is to get all the strays, start herding them in, try to get them in to that safe place for the night. It's interesting how much advice I've heard given to pastors before I came to Calvary Chapel. Advice I still hear, books that I see, that look like they're written for heads of major corporations and political leaders, because it's all about motivating, manipulating, and controlling people. And I have seen, before I came to Calvary, I was on staff at what and then was the largest charismatic church in the world. I was one of the music directors. This guy was like a general that was our pastor. We weren't actually allowed to call him by his name. We had to call him Dr. So-and-so. And his idea of being a pastor was that once a week you personally fly over the sheep with a helicopter, or you hire somebody to fly over the sheep and drop bales of hay on them. And then you go back to your palatial multi-million dollar home and with your unlisted phone number, and you don't actually have to get sheep poop on your shoes. You don't have to smell sheep. You don't have to hang out where sheep hang out. And that's not what this word means, is it? This word shepherd. It means you're going to have to be around smelly sheep. I've discovered something in my years of ministry, 33 years that I've been an ordained minister. Sheep are carnivorous. Not a lot of people don't know that, but sheep eat meat because I've got sheep bites all over my body. It was one of the reasons I didn't want to be a pastor again. You can't turn your back on him. Some of them you can't. Some of them are nice, docile, little fluffy, wonderful little things that you give names to. But you know, some of them have fangs. Whoever it is that keeps trying to call me must not know me, or they would know that I'm in church tonight. So I'm teaching a Bible study. My leg is buzzing. I'm pretty sure it's not arthritis. Nurture, guard, guide, fold, tend. Those are all synonyms of this word, shepherd. And the flavor of all of these other words when he says, don't do it because you have to, because you can't get out of the job. Do it because you want to, because you actually care, not just because you're in it for the perks. All these things that Peter says. There's really, I heard this, and I can't quote it exactly. I should have written the quote down. But it impacted me, the thought that the only way Jesus could be the ideal shepherd was because he loved the sheep. And this person that was writing this said, that's the only way you're going to be able to do it too. If you're doing it for any other reason, then you love him. And you want to love those that he loves, and you're doing it for love. He said, that's going to be so tested that you'll give up. And I have been tested, and I have at times have given up. It's the love of Jesus that keeps bringing me back. So nurture, guard, guide, fold, tend. One little note on this, as I was looking all of these words up and all of these synonyms just to get the as fat of a understanding of what it meant to shepherd, verb, shepherd, because that's the definition of my job. One of the things that I noticed is that men are normally not nurturers. I realize that's a generalization, that there are some men who are. I would say that probably the number of men who are naturally nurturers is quite small, proportionately. Usually it's women that are nurturers. And yet it's unmistakable that when a man's called to be a pastor, that's part of his job. And a lot of men don't know how to do it. They don't know how to do it because their dad never did it and his dad never did it, and they have no examples around them. They don't know how to do it. I would say the Bible says that when you see somebody that is ministering with that kind of a heart, that Jesus heart, it says, honor people like that. Take note. Watch them. Learn from them. I'm fortunate that I have men like that in my life. I'm fortunate that my father was that way. So, what happens if God's called somebody to be a pastor? There's lots of reasons why people are pastors. And it's not always God that called them. I know a bunch of guys in the ministry today that are there because their wives always wanted to be married to pastors. And we won't go there. I know guys that just love to tell people what to do. And it's one arena where they can do it. But let's suppose God's called you and you're not naturally gifted in nurturing. Remember what we talked about on Sunday? We talked about it last Wednesday as well. The things that I may not be good at, that Jesus asks me to do, he is good at. It's natural for him. It may not be natural for me, but it's natural for him. Oh, too bad. Well, wait a minute. He's living in me. Oh, well, Lord, I don't have to do it. You don't know my personality. I'm like that. And he says, yeah, well, wait a minute. I'm not asking you to do it in your own strength. I'm in you. I'll teach you how. God's commands are God's enablings. Andrew Murray says, I love that quote. God is never going to command me to do something. He's never going to, even like Peter, give me counsel as to the way I ought to do something without enabling me to do it. And of course, if you look at Jesus, as you look at this list, you'll realize Jesus is the perfect example. If he's living in me, he can do this. So, shepherd, nurture, guard, guide, fold, tend, feed. The flock of God. God's flock. I had to underline that.